I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. It's our regular time to talk about the previous year, 2016. One of the interesting things is there were an array of people attacking Putin and Russia and aligning and like that. But that's enough about the U.S. election. Let's talk about real world events. Russia's a big thing, right, Jim? Even though their GDP is low, they're shrinking. When you compare their population size to the U.S. or China, let's take China, Russia only has about 113 million people, so they don't have the numbers that they used to have. So what happened to them during the last year?
Well, Russia's been desperately trying to remain relevant, and they've been fairly successful at that. Mainly through what they've been doing in Syria with their ally Iran. Russia basically has declared victory again in Syria. And it does look like the rebels are on the ropes. I mean, that was one of the big stories of 2016. The rebel alliance, as we have pointed out in our reporting, was always fragile from the beginning when it turned out most of the rebels were joining Islamic terrorist organizations, for want of a better term. Now, some of them were Islamic conservative, and there is an Islamic alliance, as it were, that is basically convinced everyone that, at least Russia and the United States, that they are rebels, but they are not dedicated to replacing Assad with a religious dictatorship. They're willing to accept a new democracy, as long as it's a fair vote and of course the Sunnis win, which they are the majority, they should. But the alliance in the meantime, tore itself apart. I think our latest update, gives some numbers there. The Iranians are now setting up the Iranians and Russians, a peace talks, which exclude all of the Al-Qaeda, ISIL, connected rebels, which is, these days nearly half of them, or a little less than half. Basically trying to broker a deal where the Assads stay in power, or at least, get off scot-free in terms of the war crimes and crimes against humanity and all the other dirty stuff they've done. Now, Putin declares this as all worthwhile. The state-controlled media in Russia has been full of stories, which are partially true, that new Russian weapons have been tested in combat, and that should convince a lot of people to buy them. It hasn't really resulted in a lot of new sales because they're losing their big customers, namely China and India, because of, basically shoddy service, poor performance, and of course, India is buying better, Western weapons, kicking and screaming, because India still has a fairly powerful Communist Party and affection for, things Russian, as well as socialist. But India is also frightened of China. China is building its own weapons, and it's basically, making its way towards becoming the replacement during the Cold War of Russia as the second most competent developer of modern weaponry. Now, a lot of that's due to stealing technology from Russia or buying it from Russia in some cases and stealing it from the West. This is something Trump is going to have to face, and that should be interesting. But in the meantime, they are making progress. And what makes China dangerous long term is that they are doing it the right way. They understand that they're not going to overnight become a developer and producer of modern, you know, state of the art, as it were, weaponry. And they're methodically, you know, developing the internal capability, which the Soviet Union was never able to do, because China has one huge advantage. Well, Russia was falling apart in the 1980s. Russia basically allowed their entrepreneurs to go back into business. Now, this despite all the corruption, which is still a major problem in China, they have been developing world-class manufacturers. Now, they are still working on some of the key technologies that allow them to make, you know, world-class weapons, especially aircraft and nuclear submarines. But they are banging away at it. I mean, they're doing it the way you have to do it. There's no quick route to achieving, you know, domestic capabilities for a lot of these technologies. The Soviets were never able to do it because they basically, the Soviet Union collapsed before they basically allowed a free market to get going. And even then they screwed it up because they kept control of all the defense industries, the state did. And they tried to start making deals to, you know, buy Western weapons and technology. That was the big deal they had with France for the two Mistral class, you know, amphibious ships. But that got screwed up when Putin decided, well, let's try and grab, you know, Ukraine. Now, Putin basically is playing with a bad hand. As they say in Texas, he's all hat and no cattle. He's basically running a con game on the Russian people, by basically being what the Russian people want. They want a strong leader. They're willing to tolerate a lot more, totalitarian government than in the West. That was always the problem with Russia. That's why the Tsar was always so roundly condemned by the West, even when the West had a lot of, monarchies operating. They all saw the Tsar as backward, and indeed, the Russians didn't really get going on the Industrial Revolution until the late 19th century. I mean, I think we've discussed this before. One of the great what-ifs is, what if the Bolsheviks hadn't won the revolution, and they'd gone ahead with their industrial, going through the Industrial Revolution, they would have ended up more like Eastern Europe, which is not too far behind Western Europe once they got, you know, free from Russian rule in the 1990s. But that's a what might have been that's never going to be. You know, they can't, that horse has, you know, left the barn a long time ago. So Putin is basically trying to, make some progress in reestablishing the old, Russian empire that the Tsars basically built up and the communists, the Bolsheviks took over. And he's not having a lot of success. That's why he's got all these problems in Ukraine. So he saw his opportunity in Syria, and he took it. But that's basically a hollow victory. They may sell some more weapons. They may get some more prestige at home. But basically, Russians, the average Russian, is looking at the declining standard of living. They're being cut off from the West. A lot of the more competent Russians are basically migrating. That started right after the 2014 and all of the sanctions on them. And a lot of the educated and capable Russians saw that, you know, there's no future. We're going back to another czar, as it were, at best. And at worst, it might be another, you know, Bolshevism. I doubt they'll go back that far, but just going back to a totalitarian government basically puts the brakes on cleaning up the corruption and allowing the economy to grow beyond dependence on natural resources like oil, natural gas, and what have you. The other big story was the defeat of ISIL. ISIL hasn't been obliterated yet. That's another story which is ongoing, because what is really going on there is the civil war within the Islamic world. That's something that few people have picked up on. What's going on in the Islamic world is not so much you know, an outbreak of Islamic terrorism, you know, Islamic, you know, radicalism, as it were, which has been popping up periodically, you know, for over 1,000 years, and basically curbing economic, scientific, et cetera, progress in the Islamic world. A lot of Muslims recognize it. As Austin can go on at length, the Turks recognize it right after World War I, but that's being reversed because they never solved the basic problem in that Islam is a militant religion which demands submission. I mean, that's what Islam literally means. It's a variation of Semitic word for, you know, submit. And their scriptures, more than any others in, you know, any other major religion, though mainly, you know, Christianity or Hinduism, preaches constant, conquest, and unlimited violence in defense of Islam. Anybody who basically resists, or tries to attack, Islam. And they're slowly coming around to that. But even if they achieve the kind of reform that Christianity achieved in the 17th century after the 30 Years' War, where they basically said, you know, maybe we should put the religion angle aside. There are more substantial things to fight over if we must fight. And that has basically held, you know, for over 300 years. But even if the Muslim world decides to do that, they would have a hard time basically changing their fundamental, you know, scriptures. Could be done, and a lot of Muslims are puzzling over exactly how they're going to do it. The Saudis are spending a lot of money trying to convince the major centers of Islamic learning, especially Egypt, which is not, you know, which is over 1,000 years since the beginning, you know, was a center of Islamic scholarship, and how should I put it, the most compelling decisions, as it were, of Islamic scholars as to what is truly Islamic and what is heretical and what have you. So you know, we're not out of the woods yet, but the wars in Africa are subduing. Of course, as Austin points out, they can blow up again. But again, the latest Austin's latest update on Congo, you know, pointed out that they did achieve a peace deal to prevent another civil war. Well, it looks like it. You know, we'll see what happens with the next update. But it goes to show you that people even in Congo, which has been a mess from the beginning, that they recognize that, you know, this constant fighting with each other is not doing anybody any good. You saw that in the also operating in Nigeria, where you had the outbreak of Islamic radicalism in the north, the Muslim north, Boko Haram. Boko Haram is still around. It will never go away. But, you know, it's been roundly condemned by the vast majority of the Nigerians, including most Muslims. The corruption is still their biggest problem, you know, as much as religious violence grabs the headlines, it's the corruption that's really hurting Nigeria more than anything else, you know, since they achieved independence in the 1960s, over 50 years ago. But the great wars, you know, that we've been reporting on, the most destructive wars that have killed the most people, they're all dying out. The wars of the leftist, you know, rebellion in South America, the FARC, the Moro insurrection, which was going on, you know, long before the United States replaced Spain as the colonial power in 1898. That is finally being settled, although there are holdouts. There's Abu Sayyaf, which is basically a gang of the kidnappers, but, they are under enormous pressure. The new guy, Duterte, whose tactics are somewhat unpopular in the West, remain, as we point out in our latest update, according to the opinion surveys in the Philippines, people agree it's dangerous, it's bloody, but they like it. You know, crime is down, drug use is down. The people were desperate. They saw no other solution. But in the meantime, they have also negotiated a settlement with the Muslim nationalists in the south, which may or may not, you know, be finalized, as it were. Still has to clear the Christian dominated their Congress to get approval. And basically, it's up to the Muslim alliance, the MILF. Unfortunately, that didn't mean what it did when they first started using it years ago. And they'll get their autonomy down there. The MILF, the majority Muslim organizations in the southern Philippines are actively fighting the last holdouts. You know, so there is hope in most of the world. The rebellions and another one in India for almost a decade now, the largest source of terrorist-related deaths were not the Islamic terrorism sent in by Pakistan, but the Maoist rebellion in eastern India. So there is progress. I mean, 2016 was in many ways a good year for peace, you know, emerging out of this what seemingly endless chaos and violence. But you know, the fundamental problem, the Islamic, you know, radicalism, is still there. And of course, you have Pakistan, which is already a nuclear state, the only Islamic state that has nuclear weapons. Iran is about to get them, although Iran. It's one of the great ironies. History is weird. Iran has always been the enemy of the Arab states, especially the Gulf Arabs. Until the oil came along and made everybody in the Gulf, you know, wealthy beyond their wildest dreams, the Iranians looked with disdain on the Bedouins, on what was in Saudi Arabia. The Turks had the same attitude. You know, they have a whole collection of sayings about don't get involved in the affairs of the Arabs, and even when they were governing most of the Arab states, they considered it, you know, their duty to try and keep peace as much as they could, but they'd rather not, which is why, you know, the Ataturk and the new Turkey, as it were, after World War I, were quite happy to, you know, wash their hands, as it were, of the Arabs. But, you know, the Arabs are back with all that oil, and the Iranians are there to ignite the thing all over again. The only good thing you can say about the Iranians, and I hate to be the bearer of this kind of news about the Iranians, they have always had a more, how should I put it, adult, you know, mature attitude, you know, towards, you know, empire building. Their empire building goes back to, you know, before Alexander the Great, you know, the Persians, whatever you want to call them, the Iranians. They've been there for, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years. And, their biggest enemy was always themselves, which remains the case. I mean, the only reason Alexander the Great, you know, conquered the Persian Empire 2,500 years ago was because the Persians were recovering from one of their perennial civil wars. I mean, the biggest enemy was themselves. They could conquer anybody around them, but the thing that always held them back was fighting among themselves, and they're still doing that because you still have the religious radicals in Iran, which are now, you know, Muslim, not some other religion, and of course you have the majority who are basically don't care about religion, they do care about, you know, Iranian power and becoming the regional superpower again, which they lost, you know, when the West came in with better technology, better weapons, and no sense of humor. Between that and the Turks, you know, the Iranians were penned in for centuries, and of course the Russians, they had to fight the Russians for a bit too. But so the Iranians as a people respond positively towards appeals to Iranian nationalism. And that's something the West doesn't understand. It's not religion that's holding the Iranians together. Sure, it's run by a religious dictatorship, but it's basically the religious dictatorship is smart enough to keep using the Iranian nationalism to maintain sufficient loyalty, you know, to keep the place from degenerating into another civil war. But that's always a possibility. So there we are. You know, the bloodletting has declined, but the threats, as it were, are still there.
Austin, can you give us fill in the holes on that great tour
of
the force?
But look, I made a short note before we started talking, and the short note says, "Nort missile tests, come home to roost." Just remember that. Now, actually, this ties in with several things that Jim said. You know, we're doing this off the top of our head, but I believe, you know, North Korea conducted 20 missile tests, has within the last 12 to 18 months. And, of course, on January 1st, in his review of 2016, January 1st of this year, Kim Jong-un gives this speech saying that we're now on the verge of deploying an ICBM that, according to missile analysts, has a 7,000-mile range, which puts most of the U.S. within range of a North Korean nuclear weapon. So those tests in 2016, they got major media. They hit made headlines. They rose to the on the radar level of mainstream media. Jim pointed out how methodical the Chinese are. I'm going to make some comments about that in a second. But North Korea, for all of its inadequacies and they're extraordinary, has been quite methodical in its continued pursuit of a nuclear weapon and the delivery system, ballistic missile delivery system, to put it on a target, whether that's Seoul, close in, South Korea, Japan, or Guam, or Hawaii. Or if you'll remember in 2013, and I think we talked about this, Dan, I know I've written a couple of newspaper columns about it, Washington, D.C. and Austin, Texas showed up on ballistic missile tracks as North Korean targets. Austin, Texas puzzled some folks. I said it was because Samsung's Western Hemisphere, chief Western Hemisphere, operation of the Western Hemisphere is here in Austin. And that's the North Koreans are terribly jealous of the South Koreans. So this is this impoverished, starving nation that gets no respect and doesn't deserve any respect politically, socially, or the like. It has to be respected. Of course, that's why one reason they go after it, for its potential as a highly disruptive and destructive nuclear terrorist state, which is what it amounts to. Now, how this integrates with Jim's made some absolutely telling points about China's methodical development of its Western weapon system. It's been methodical, ups and downs, you know, the corruption problems and a lack of real experience with real rule of law, but it's been methodical about modernizing or slowly modernizing its economy. But it's also been methodical about its strategic expansion, and that continued in 2016. You know what I'm referring to? Artificial islands in the South China Sea. What was interesting? Vince, you said you didn't want to talk about the U.S. election, but the Chinese know, they know that they're not there yet with the strategic expansion to include the weapon systems and the military and the like. They're brittle. They're at a fragile state. So that's why Trump shook them up with just taking a phone call from Taiwan. There is a solidifying political opposition to the Chinese, despite the way Jim brought up Duterte in the Philippines. He's an interesting character. There's no question about that. But you know, he played up to the Chinese, despite the Philippine military saying, no, our allies are the U.S. China is not going to be our ally, because they know that China has territorial and regional domination ambitions. So you didn't want the U.S. election. It's not so much U.S. election. It's U.S. An indicator of U.S.-Chinese relations. The Chinese have certainly read it that way. Trump just taking a phone call from Taiwan, because the great methodical strategic expansion, economic, military, and territorial is fragile. And that was certainly that's you see why I'm saying that's important is something that occurred in 2016 because of the implications. Jim brought up the perennial problem of how do you moderate or produce a reformed Islam. I've given a talk about this, and I have done it twice, maybe in the last 25 years, but I refer to a talk I heard at the University of Texas in 1990. So the first time I gave it was not too long after I heard this talk at the University of Texas by a Turkish scholar who was visiting from one of the universities in the Istanbul area, and he was an expert in Islamic history. And he took a question from the audience. He says, okay, what about the issues of militant Islam? And he was a Muslim himself, Sunni Muslim. He says, look, this has been the problem. Where is there a reformed Islam? There certainly models for it, and it wasn't treated lightly. Even though, and I would say a third of the audience was Muslim on this. And but there's a little bit of a right, and the highly educated people attending a talk at a university. And the fellow says, look, you can provide Quranic evidence that the Allah doesn't want you to kill people who want to get along with you. Very simple. Okay, well, there's a lot more to it than that. But he was offering a quote-unquote line, an interpretive line, of reinterpreting the Quran so you can get along with your neighbor who doesn't worship exactly like you do. And of course, in that audience, everybody in there knew about the divisions with Islam, not just Shia and Sunni. And that's where you go back to Jim's point about the great civil war, Islamic civil war. There are multiple factions. Now, the reason I refer to that talk, I've heard that and read it. It's not new. It was just interesting to hear a discussion in a forum like that, and it does not predate Islamic terror. But at the time, it certainly predates Al Qaeda and the latest virulent version of Islamist terror organizations. Most of the operations at that time were related to Palestine or Palestinians. So there was a quote-unquote nationalist or even a pan-Arab element to the Muslim terror of the 1990 and earlier. Now, I'm being very general about it, but that's what I've said that has some degree of validity. One thing, though, that we saw in 2016 is this isn't new, but it's certainly some of the wrinkles. The wrinkles were there in 2014, 2015, 2016. Is when you want to call them ISIL or the Islamic State or whatever, it's exporting its war to Europe and the U.S. And who do they exploit? Psychologically vulnerable, who we ought to call the sick, the disenchanted, the alienated. Well, Al Qaeda could make that appeal primarily within Muslim countries, but ISIL is exploiting this through the internet to recruit Well, they're not necessarily lone wolves. They have they have contacts with other people who are individuals who are attracted to the Islamic State or are willing to act on its behalf. That's a tough one to figure out from a security standpoint, because you're dealing with you've got free societies that have a high degree of quote unquote porosity, meaning that you can buy things and move things and move with a reasonable degree of freedom, so they can acquire weapons and step into a nightclub in somewhere in Florida and calmly murder 50 people. Again, that was not new to 2016, but we certainly saw many examples of it. And in Europe, that the tie-in there has been to the surge of refugees and migrants. They're not all refugees. A substantial number are Muslims from displaced by the war in Syria. That's something that really came home in 2016, and the Europeans are wrestling with it politically. You've seen that reflected with a rise of quote unquote nationalist groups in Germany. They tend to immediately label them neo-fascist. Some of the ones in Germany are. There's no question about that. But it certainly added to the political appeal of the hard right in France. And there's why it becomes difficult, and difficult for a lot of the mainstream media to discuss, is because many of the citizens of these democracies in Germany and France say, hey, we do have a legitimate national security issue, international security issue. I'm not afraid of the French anymore. The Germans and the French, we're not really afraid of the Germans. We're afraid of folks who come in and set off bombs because we don't worship the way they do. And of course, what they're talking about are the Islamic extremists that slipped in with the surge of refugees. Which, after all of that, I'm just picking up on some of the things that Jim said. Oh yeah, I guess I'm going to get back to the rogue missile shot. Jim talked about the deep story in Iran. Shoot, I refer to the 1996 third edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. I think the Iran chapter in that particular edition, which some of it was used in the 2008 edition too, caught that component of the Khomeini's revolution and described it rather effectively. He's right. But one of the things they've got now is an advancing nuclear program. And what do they want with that? The ability to not just, they say they're going to go after the Israelis, but it's to threaten the other Semites over there, the Arabs. It's also to buff their credentials with the Pakistanis and the Russians and the Turks. They're not in the same. They're not as how do I want to word this? They're not as unstable as North Korea, but nevertheless, they're playing something of a similar game, and they've made strides, I fear, in obtaining nuclear weapon and delivery systems. Which gets me back to when I said, the huge threat from a terrorist state, one whether we've got a nuclear weapon, we may only have one or two shots, but let's say we blow up the Ghawar oil field or shoot your capital, and then we think then hunker down or threaten to have the ability to strike back at London and Paris. This This isn't fantasy, Dan. They're not there yet in Tehran, and they're not there yet in Pyongyang. But they want to those are goals they want to reach. And both the Iranians and the North Koreans made advances in 2016. Sorry to end on that note, but there's my fill in the gaps.
Well, it's
Jim, do you disagree with anything I said on
that? No, the North Koreans are something China basically created themselves by tolerating their weapons development for so long. But when the Chinese noted that Chinese popular opinion, which is still monitored, they're trying to control it, was turning decidedly against North Korea. You know, for a long time, most Chinese went along with the fiction that, you know, North Koreans were their fraternal brothers, et cetera, et cetera. But over the last 10 years, I guess, well, especially since Kim Jong-un took power, most Chinese have decided on their own that the North Koreans are basically a threat to everyone. And eventually the Chinese leadership came to agree with that. But now, of course, you know, they're stuck with very few options because Kim Jong-un has made it very clear that he wants his nukes. And he'll get them any way he can. And you've also got to keep in mind that China is the, how should I put it, the ancient, you know, enemy of Korea. Korea was always caught between two, you know, threatening powers. China, which was always the dominant one, and normally had Korea, the several kingdoms of Korea, paying tribute and basically just promising not to raid into Chinese territory proper. But after the experience with the Russian-Japanese War, where the Japanese took over Korea and showed the Koreans that the fear of the Japanese was fully justified. I mean, the Japanese are still to this day, you know, first-rate racists. You know, we talk about racism in this country, but it's nothing compared to what you see in most other parts of the world. But that's a whole other story.
But you get the truth on Strategy Page, Jim. That's the truth.
That's true. But anyway, it's a minority. Right. The problem is that that North Korea is out of control, and what everybody's waiting for is the whole thing to collapse, which is slowly making progress towards, because the economy is dysfunctional, doesn't function. What resources are available are dedicated to the small ruling class, you know, the 10% of the population, to keep the other 90% in line. And even they are crumbling at the edge. We report this, you know, regularly in Strategy Page, and there's plenty of evidence to back it up. You know, this is not just Aaron speculation. You know, there are real provable things happening in there which do not bode well, you know, for the continued existence of the North Korean government. The problem everybody is concerned about, what happens after. South Korea is worried that they wouldn't, that North Koreans actually are torn between whether they'd like to go with South Korea or China. Because more have escaped and settled in China, which is a hostile environment for them. And about 30,000 have gotten to South Korea, where they basically, you know, although there's culture shock and what have you, they have problems. They've done very well. But the Chinese have told South Korea in no uncertain terms, if North Korea collapses, it will not be part of the United Korea. At best, they can hope for a puppet state of China. China is drawing a red line, as it were, and they tend to be more diligent about enforcing those red lines. That they do not want a thriving democracy on their borders. It's bad enough, you know, the South Koreans are close enough to infect China with their culture and their obvious example of the fruits of democratic, rule. The South Korean ability to put corrupt politicians out of power or in jail, which they just impeached the first female, you know, president of South Korea because she got caught, you know, being too cozy with their corrupt buddies. Now, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that seems like nothing to us, but in East Asia, that's big news.
Oh, listen, that Jim, you've just laid into something that's absolutely correct. South Korea, on so many levels, is a screaming success. And look, and the Chinese know that. The Chinese are aware that's with the implication that we don't want you moving any further north. The thing is, there are so many. There's a lot of room. Dan, may I use this strategy talk as an appeal to our Chinese hacker brigades that listen to us to pass this on up the line to Beijing? There's so much room for an agreement. But among Japan, South Korea, China, and the U.S. over North Korea. And if it's a buffer state or whatever, just in one that isn't going to nuke everybody. And China has no interest in belligerence, aggressiveness, and the potential violence that the Kim regime in Pyongyang presents as a constant threat to that region and the rest of the world. They need to be, if they need, they need to be put in a box, a desolate box, fine. But they need to be lose those nukes and ballistic missiles. They'll destroy everybody's day is what will happen. So I just made that appeal, Dan. I hope that hackers will pass it on.
Let's finish up with I don't think we really touched much on Central America or South America. We've got Mexico bubbling along with some problems. Venezuela is basically collapsed, right? They're a non-nation state or something.
It's another shining example of how socialism works if you get
it. Right. If you implement it properly, it doesn't work.
Dan, I'm going to have to go in a second, but let me say something about Colombia. After the peace agreement was initially rejected, and there were bona fide reasons for rejecting it, what they came back with and worked out, and the fact that most of the ex-communist guerrillas still agreed to it because they knew they were beat, that's positive. There's still some splinter factions. Leftist splinter factions, and I think some of them are actually narco guerrillas fighting the state, but that's a success. That's a success. Yep. You're right about Venezuela. Jim just said everything you need to know about Maduro and Chavismo. What's the way to implement socialism? And the thing on Mexico, I'll tell you, Peña is one of the least popular people in Mexico. It's the wages of impunity. Go back into September 2014 and the Iguala massacre. So much has come to fore, and the exposure of they're not all priestas. You know, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, that's the Peña's party, but it's many of the politicians that have been arrested or accused of corruption or priestas. You've had some panistas and a few PRD caught as well. And he cannot escape the tar of the endemic corruption. He's going to limp along until he's not going to be toppled. No, he's not going to be removed, in my view on this. He's going to limp along. But he has no moral authority, and the narco war is going to continue to be fought in fits and starts with the military in the fore. Despite one of the most interesting statements out of Mexico to me was made in early December by the general who's head of the army. He's Secretary of Defense, but that's the way that it's structured, and he says, you know, we really didn't ask for this mission. The military, and he was speaking about the Army and the Navy, even though he's nominally in control of the Navy. I mean, essentially, highly cooperative. He says, we didn't ask for this mission. We're not structured for it, but there's nobody else to do it. And it was almost an informal press conference. He'd given a talk, and then he sits there, and it was that is a genuine complaint from the Mexican military. He flat out said, this is really a police problem. he did not say, as far as I could tell, and I read almost all of the material that was available on this conference, that it was an institutional problem. But he certainly said, you know, acknowledged all the weak institutions within Mexico. I understand that this is the senior commander in the military coming out and acknowledging what most the overwhelming majority of Mexican citizens know. Is that, you know, this is a police problem. It should be handled by the police. But there's a pause, and then he says they're just not up to it. So going to continue. The cartel war is going to continue to rock along. And, Jim, the homicide rate's gone up, didn't it? Didn't it go up in 2016 in
yes.
Mexico? Yeah. Sorry, Dan. There's some bad news.
Right. Jim, would you talk a little bit about Brazil and their... You know, they've got they're the seventh largest GDP in the world, and actually they're probably sixth when you don't take into account that they're counting the European Union there, which is obviously starting to fracture. What sort of are they exerting power into the area and building their own areas of influence in South America?
Well, they're trying to, but they're suffering the same problem that the other South American states have, is an old fondness for statism, whether it's socialism or simply crony capitalism. They basically have a hard time implementing the reforms. You know, cracking down on corruption. And allowing the economy to thrive, you know, unhindered, that have been, you know, the key to American success. I mean, you know, basically what we inherited from England was something that made the English, you know, unique, for most of the last 500 years. That was what the Normans implemented, you know, basically a trustworthy, judiciary. I mean, compared to the other European states and Napoleon, the French are always jealous of this. They basically standardized all the rules. They allowed anybody with an economic beef to basically go to court, or then they had the parliament, which gave more and more power. And this basically led to the Industrial Revolution, which in England got going first, and they became, you know, quite the superpower. We inherited from them. But, you know, as I think it was Benjamin Franklin said, you have a republic if you can keep it. In other words, he and Benjamin and many of the other, you know, the creators of our Constitution recognized that corruption is a constant problem. Jefferson, I think, was the one who famously said, we need a revolution every 20 years. And just in talking about bringing the thing down, but basically going out there and putting a lot of your officials in jail. The reforms, which we have periodically had every 30 or 40 years, and it looks like we're in line for another one now. It's got a lot of very wealthy and very important people nervous because, you know, as the latest election showed, you know, that even the Republicans were in favor of Trump. But what Trump was going for was another wave of this reform. We had the great reforms, you know, in the late 19th century. Roosevelt, Roosevelt just couldn't get away from this stuff. But anyway, they basically said, you got to basically rein in the crony capitalism, you know, give more protections, you know, what they call panics turned into the Great Panic, or the Great Depression, we called it. And that basically brought into effect a lot of rules which made one less likely, until they started repealing them in the 1990s. And that was when a Democrat was in power, Clinton, who saw, well, we can handle this, you know, who this again. And of course, when a total wild card, like Teddy Roosevelt was, you know, came along in the form of Trump, a Democrat turned Republican turned reformer, they said, oh my God, we can't have this. And they're all trying to demonize him, you know, into powerlessness, but they're just not getting it. And you could see what was coming, you know, back in the 90s, when the Republicans tried, you know, the contract with America, we're going to clean it up. And you had all those reform politicians going in and either quitting in disgust or joining the corruption. You know, they tried the Tea Party, which got demonized. No violence there, just saying, hey, look, you know, we're going down the wrong path. And so we can only hope that another, you know, revolution, as it were, Jeffersonian revolution, will succeed and we'll be able to move forward again without all the encumbrance of the crony capitalism and the, the socialism in the form of promises your grandchildren can't keep, which we're now coming due now, especially in states like, Illinois and California and what have you. The one exception being Texas, which is vilified for being, said a bunch of old fogies and wild entrepreneurs and what have you. Guilty as charged, Wilson, they agree.
Well, look, hey, just on that, just generally correct, but hidden way back there, even down here in Texas, is a lurking public pensions problem. However, it was discussed, Jim, 15, 16 years ago. I saw it mentioned even was running through the Texas Comptroller's office. So there has been an attempt to begin to deal with it incrementally. So I just say that's something that I'm not trying to just tout Texas. There really is no quote-unquote Texas model. There's a certain kind of demand from the citizens of Texas about the way things, the way to run things. So Texas detected that. And look, Illinois and California and their pensions issue are the canaries in the coal mine. That's it. That's, I don't know that it threatens Utah, but, and I don't know what the Colorado situation is and the like, but the public pensions issue is something that threatens all the states.
Well, that was always the great problem with democracy. That's a problem that's been argued, debated for thousands of years, literally. It's what brought the Roman Republic down and what have you. And, of course, the only solution is to periodically clean up your act.
Totally right. And, I said 20 minutes ago I've got someplace I need to go. I do. This is really interesting.
All right.
Here Dunnigan and I are supposed to be your internationalists and all this other stuff. Here we're talking about, but we're the thing is what kicked this off is Jim's point about what South Korea's doing. South Korea's doing it right.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll wrap it up there. And a year from now, we'll do another one of these. And we'll look forward to your gentlemen's comments throughout the year on the various subjects we'll talk about. Have a good day, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.